This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Welcome, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. The number 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. Dr. Lupinacci, how are you, my friend?
Good, Tim. How's it going, man? It's going well here. So just glad to see you on here and still decompressing from an awesome show yesterday with Educators Amplified and all of our amazing callers. That was live, or as the kids say, it was lit.
Gotta love Wednesday.
Got you and producer Anya laughing, right?
Which kids I'm gonna are use still all those saying tonight. Lit?
I mean, Busted Pencils is bossing.
Oh, geez, man. I don't know. I'm looking at producer Anya, and she's kind of like, dude, I don't know that that's the language of our time.
I don't know if you're in time with how that language is used is more what I'm worried about. But gentlemen, go on about your expertise. I'll go on about mine. Don't worry.
All right. Education talk, no cap.
Yeah, we got it.
You know, that one was much better. There you go.
Well, you know, for all the Generation X people out there, that's my generation out there.
Me
you know,
too, me too. I just experiment with the other generation's lingo when I can misuse it, and as they tell me, it's cringe.
Oh well, you see there, Anya. I see our guest is in there, but we're gonna hold off.
Well, let's give it a shot here.
Let's give him a shot there.
Because we do have an amazing guest tonight, and it's always great when we can have our guests on. And here he is. Holy smokes.
Dr. Julian, do you have us? Can you see us? Can you hear us, my friend?
I can see you. I can hear you.
Hey, all right. Well, we're live. You're streaming in.
Welcome. We got you in here. Yes, it's a special episode tonight, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Our guest, the Provost, Vice President, Academic Affairs, Western Michigan University, just testified in front of Congress last week, Dr. Julian Vasquez-Helig. How are you doing, my friend?
Pretty good. Good. It's good. Glad to join you again. Hi, Ted.
Yeah, this is... What do you think of the new digs here, man? You like this? You know, we got nice. The nice background. Yeah, I mean, we got people on the live YouTube. We got people on the live Facebook. We got people on the live Twitter. We got people, you know, listening live. We got people listening. As Johnny always says, we got people in Finland listening to Julian. So, you know, and you know how they do that with the Civic Media app. You know, just in case after the show, Julian, you're looking for something to download the Civic Media app, take it that way. You can that way you'll always have me and Johnny with you at all times right there. Julian, Congress, sitting there, charter schools, accountability. Man, dude, how was it?
No, it's good. You know, I've had some opportunities in life to do that work at the state level in Texas and in California. You know, and Congress, I've done hearings too on different bills, briefings, I guess I should say, but it was the first time that I'd been there, you know, been a single witness, for a particular perspective and, to go back and forth with the questions. There was a couple gotcha questions too, it was good to, you know, I thought I acquitted the perspective well.
No, I really did. So Julian, just to remind listeners, we had the testimony out on the internet today, but you were, you know, talking to Congress, testifying largely around the charter schools and accountability. And what's great is you have a pretty long history as being in that charter school movement, not just from this kind of a critiquing standpoint. Julian, just give us a sense of saying, you know, charter schools, what they were supposed to be and what they are and where we should go.
Yes. So I first experienced charter schools when I did a project back in when I was in graduate school at Michigan back in the 1990s. And, you know, charter schools, as they originally envisioned, were these laboratories of opportunity where innovation could occur, and then that innovation would, you know, be adopted by other schools, other districts, et cetera. That was the original idea. And especially if you look at the way Al Shanker saw them when he came along, thinking about this in the 80s, it was related to teachers being able to do that at scale, do that innovation work at scale. So, you know, I started out studying them in the 1990s. Michigan was one of the earlier adopters of charter schools. And then, you know, fast forward to East Palo Alto, California, and I was a 21st century learning instructor in the fourth grade at an Aspire charter school. Mm. Later was on a charter school board. And was a parent of a charter school, was even a donor. So I was, I just had a lot of experience, and I didn't realize that later it would become a part of my scholarly endeavors. But I started to study charter schools midstream through my experience as a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. And Texas was adopting charter schools quite rapidly. They were being hailed or called a panacea, especially for Black students. But I remember a buddy of mine and I were invited to...
lost a little volume there, Julian. Johnny, you're not hearing Julian, right? Just to, no, yeah, jump in. See if we can get his audio... Yeah, see if we can get his audio back there. Jillian cannot. It's okay. We'll try to bring it back here. But there he is.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess when someone calls you on your phone, it brings you out. What was the last thing you heard? Sorry about that.
You're making the from Texas, and then, you know, the reality that you were then studying charter schools, and just your multiple experiences that are, you know, kind of leading you up to and saying, you know, where we are.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I think I'm in Austin, Texas right now. Kip had invited us to go visit their school, and they were being hailed as a panacea for Black students. They were saying that, you know, 100% of their kids were going to college. You know, this is late 2000s or so. And so we went out there and we're thinking about publishing this study for Kip. And you know, they were telling us that they were having a hard time keeping Black families at the school. So we were going to investigate that for them. We're going to write an article about it. And so then what happened is 2 weeks later, a couple weeks later, Kip was on Oprah talking about how great they were for African American students, for Black students. And that kind of sounded a little strange to me, because they literally just had us out to the school a few weeks earlier telling us that they were having trouble with that very thing. So we wanted to publish this study, but then Kip called back and said, look, you can't do this study. You know, we're getting all this attention for being such a positive experience for Black students. And so you can do the study, but you can't publish it. And so I thought, wow, that's really unusual. And my mother always told me, where there's smoke, there's fire. So I was a director of a policy center at UT Austin, and I had access to all the Texas data. It was in a small room in the basement of the College of Education. So I went down to the room, and I went ahead and ran the numbers for Kip, and was looking at what were their numbers. And they were losing 40% of their Black students over time before they graduated. But yet they were saying that they were having graduation rates that were sky high and 100%, and everybody was going to college. And so 100% of 60% didn't add up to 100% for me. So that was really the beginning of my research journey, because we published this study in the Berkeley Review of Education about, you know, using that data about KIPP and about other charter schools, and found that, you know, students were more likely to leave, Black students were more likely to leave charter schools in Texas. And then KIPP was livid. They had a press release, you know, because KIPP used to be like this, you know, very prominent charter school, largest charter school in the nation. And they wrote a press release, and they were just all over it. And but I didn't have any way to respond You know, they had all this media calling me. And so that's when I started my blog, Cloaking Inequity. It was because I had written this study about a charter school and about KIPP, and they had pushed back so hard, and I didn't really have an outlet for the work. And so I started this blog, Cloaking Inequity, thinking it was just a project that people would read there in Texas or in Austin. And, you know, 200 countries later and more than a million readers later, all because of KIPP. So
there it is. Our guest, Dr. Jillian Vasquez-Helig, Western Michigan University Provost there, Johnny Lupinacci. Did you know that history right there with Jillian?
You know, these are the stories that help set the context for this important defending work that, you know, Dr. Jillian and others are doing as well, but so important to, you know, testify and give, you know, speak truth to power when it comes to what's happening with charter schools in terms of how it impacts our public education system.
Well, and Jillian, we last week had Carol Burris on from the network with you, you know, really going over grading the state legislatures, but you know, she's been on talking about the charter schools. And so, you know, and what big with, you know, in Wisconsin, Milwaukee too, as you say, you know, the hotbed, one of the hotbeds of choice, and then charters right there, and really looking at the letter grade that Milwaukee and Wisconsin got was a D, really close to an F, and a lot of that was on the regulatory, or should we say non-regulatory nature of charter schools and choice all through Wisconsin. Is that one of the, because you say like KIPP, it's like, well, you know, this is supposed to be this great place for students of color, but yet you're finding out the retention rate is not that great. Is that coming back to that when we say how they report and how their abilities, you know, is this is one of those things that I hear more now too, as you're saying after this, is saying, well, they don't want regulations, though, that would hold them to the standards of transparency, of which you found out very early on that they were going to fight transparency. And here we are now, you know, how many years later? And the reality is that the fight to keep this charter school choice, all of this in such an opaque, if not just totally under the covers, keeping it away from the from families, the data, the access there. Our guest, yes, Dr. Jillian Vasquez-Helig, Western Michigan University Provost, just testified with Congress, Charter Schools Accountability, Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk, 855-752-4842. More when we get back. Oh, yeah, there it is. Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk, 855-752-4842. Our guest, Dr. Jillian Vasquez-Helig, Provost, Western Michigan University, testified in front of Congress, charter schools regulations. Man, they got some work to do talking about the early experience of doing the investigation as a researcher, putting together and finding that, you know, some of the data isn't really lining up with KIPP schools, creates Cloaking Inequity, the blog. Jillian, but I mean, you have been not, you know, you made a point to talk about this. I mean, you're a researcher, you're a faculty member, you were a fourth grade teacher. Your intersection and connections with both as a teacher, a researcher, a scholar, and now a leader in education, how is that all shaping up in the world of advocacy? Because one of the things we try to really talk a lot about on Busted Pencils is public schools, you know, public higher education, all public education, the foundation of democracy. And your work exemplifies the advocacy for democracy. And just wanted to give you some props there and let you do a little bit more bragging about that.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any bragging. I mean, the work we do as leaders is service, right? And of course, you know, when talking about charter schools, I'm really coming from my scholarly background. you know, there's quite a wide variety of perspectives about charter schools on our faculty, as you could imagine. So the work that we do as leaders, either it's as in civil rights or in academia, you know, my mother always told me, to whom much is given, much is expected, right? So I understand that when I was in D.C. talking about, you know, the scholarly inquiry and my background experiences, that not everyone, you know, had heard a lot of those perspectives, right? The common perspective about charter schools is that their achievement, they knock it out the park. They're an incredible alternative to the narrative of what they call failing schools. And I did ask one congressperson, how do you define failing school? And she said, no, you tell me how to define failing school. And I thought to myself, but I thought you asked me the question about failing school, but that's a whole nother conversation. And it was really an opportunity to talk about counter narrative, right? Because, you know, if you look at the work that Credo does, and we know that, and here's the thing that we know about research in DC, is that there are think tanks that Democrats go to, there are think tanks that Republicans go to for information. That's just part of the deal. And the thing is that the Credo work comes out of the Hoover think tank that is located on the grounds of Stanford University. It's not Stanford University. You know, it's a privately funded think tank, typically funded by organizations that fund folks from more of a right-wing political perspective. And so it's important to understand that when research comes from think tanks, you know, if you go to Brookings, you know what you're going to get from Brookings. And so I think it's important that context. And so when we talk about research, you know, as a scholar, we're really focused on peer-reviewed research, work that has gone through peers and has been approved. But when it comes from think tanks and these types of things, they don't go through the double-blind peer review process. So I think that when you look at the achievement data and these sorts of things, that they're always highlighting Credo. It's like a constant drumbeat for the last 14 years. But it's important to understand that research doesn't come from an independent place. And even with a stacked deck, and, you know, they make selections, like, for example, when you do the research on charter schools, they compare, we believe, 95% of charter school students to less than 40% of public school students. Even when they stack the deck like that, there's very small differences between charter school students and students in neighborhood schools, even when you stack the deck. So, you know, there was one question, I think, was from Congressman Bobby Scott, and he asked if charter schools, you know, how did they perform compared to neighborhood public schools? Well, very similarly, it depends on the subgroup, it depends on the city in terms of achievement. But we also have to think about the fact that charter schools often take problems that we already have in neighborhood public schools and actually make them worse. So our public schools are already segregated, but charters are even more segregated than our segregated public schools. We already have a problem with teacher attrition in neighborhood public schools. Well, guess what? Charter schools have even more attrition than neighborhood public schools. We already have a problem with teacher quality. One in every three teachers in charter schools has less than 3 years experience. It's one in five in neighborhood public schools. So a lot of the things that we know are issues, discipline, especially for Black and brown boys, that problem in our public schools, it's even worse in charter schools. And so that's one of the concerns, is we're always, there, you know, there's a side to this conversation that's always talking about failing schools and government schools and, you know, how can you possibly, you know, parents should have this option and that option. What we really need to be talking about is that charter schools take a lot of the problems that we already have in our neighborhood public schools and make them worse. And I think one other quick point, let's even say that charter schools are 1/100th or 2/100th of a standard deviation better than charter school, which is a number that's more than zero, but is nearly zero. There are education reforms that are much more beneficial in terms of their effect in the research literature. And I know this is in the weeds a little bit, but class size reduction, 400 or 500% more effective than charter schools. Early childhood education, 400 or 500% more effective in the research literature than most charter schools. And yet we are talking about charter schools and school choice all the time. But here's the reason why. It's not necessarily because they're more effective. It's because it fits a particular ideology. And that ideology is that schools shouldn't be, and that's why they call them government schools. The ideology is that schools should be privately managed. But I believe schools are a public good and are really, really key to our democracy and shouldn't be run by corporations or for-profits. And so that's the big, big conversation, I think, in charter schools that's often not discussed enough. It's not discussed, like, how do we think public education should take place? Should it be done by private organizations like companies or nonprofits, or should we do it collectively as a public good?
Johnny Lupinacci.
Well, man, it's excellent. And it's great, Julian, to have you laying that out for our listeners, because so often our callers, call in and they talk about, hey, what is this all about? This idea of school choice, or, you know, how much are charters really hurting? I think you just laid it out really clearly for listeners. So if you're out there and you want to be part of this conversation, give us a call, 855-752-4842. You know, and here we have Dr. Julian, Vasquez Helig here, and he's coming fresh off testifying, but sharing that background and really laying out why it is the myth, why there's a myth that charter schools fix the problems that we have in education. In fact, I just want to amplify and echo, he's here sharing, they haven't fixed that. And in many cases, they've made the problem worse. So I think that's really great to have that just clear as day, laid out in the numbers and in the facts, why it's a problem.
But Julian, when you're talking about this too, the idea, the focus on public schools and the collective good, I mean, I really hear that coming across. You say, we're trying to, quote, fix problems. And the reality is that when you just said here, it's like, well, you want some research proven, quote, fixes. They're out there, and none of them deal with privatizing or moving away from common public schools. They never move in that direction. Yeah. We're always coming back. Hey, Julian, when we get back, though, too, I want to talk a little bit more about charters, but then I also want to make that pivot into the high-stakes testing kind of conversation that we continue to have in public schools. It's Busted Pencils. It's Fully Leaded Education Talk. 855-752-4842. More with Dr. Julian when we get back. There it is. Yeah. Thursday night, Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk, Educated Educators Talking Education, 855-752-4842. Our guest, he's the provost from Western Michigan University, Dr. Julian Vasquez Helig. And we're talking charter schools and democracy and public schools and inequities and all of those things. And Julian, we left the idea, really situating the realities of, if whatever you want to call, quote, a failing school, actually from the research literature, there's pretty good quality research out there that says, you want to do this, reduce class sizes. You want to do this, early childhood education. You want to do the research just doesn't say privatize, charterize, and segregate more schools based on choice.
Right. Yeah. No. There are gold standards in the research literature, but all of those gold standards require, quite a bit of investment. And so we as a nation have to be willing to make those investments. There's a $20 billion difference in funding between districts that are primarily white and primarily students of color. 20 billion, that's billion with a B. And the thing is, everybody knows that that's the case in our country.
Julian, there's some amazing stuff happening out there, and I'd love to hear. We've read about it, for those of us in that research and in that literature, and it's been discussed some on the show from time to time. But there are like canaries in the coal mine. There are places like Detroit, New Orleans, and I think even internationally, some examples of what people do when they exercise their democratic right to say public education matters to us. Yeah. Do you have any of those, those shining stories that help kind of illuminate things?
Yeah. Let me, you come home and you say you want to talk about the good news or the bad news. Let me talk about the bad news first. Now, in the hearing, we were talking about New Orleans, and there was a framing of what was happening in New Orleans as being positive, which is that Every school has become a charter school. The challenge is that, you know, we took a look at this. We took a look at the NAEP scores, the ACT scores, ACT, SAT scores, and the NAEP, and found that New Orleans and Louisiana were last and nearly last, and we're still doing so, you know, a decade after Katrina. Now, some folks want to hold it up as an incredible shining beacon of what's possible with charter schools, but when I looked at this data, it was not something to be proud of. And I think it's also important to note that there's a country that has 100% choice in the world, and that's Chile. And that happened because after democracy was abolished in Chile, Pinochet put in a universal choice system. They came to the United States and they talked to the folks at the University of Chicago, Milton Friedman and others, and they made a 100% universal choice system. And what happens in a universal choice system now, many years later, and you saw a decade of protests from parents and students about problems with this in Chile. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, I'm going to say this quickly because I know we got to get into some other stuff, is that you had public schools that had lower resource and had primarily the low achieving and low SES students. Then you have all the wealthy, nice public schools, and you can think about those wealthy, nice public schools in your community. Those stay around. And then you have private schools, and those private schools decide which students they want from those other schools. And so you get further stratification when you have universal choice. And that was the first thing a dictator went to after he abolished democracy, was to put in universal school choice.
Well, there it is right there, you know, kind of putting that forward. And so in a direction, you know, as people are saying, we need choice. Well, let's be careful what we're actually wishing for out there. And again, if public schools need some, quote, fixing or things to improve, which they do, we have ways to do that and continue the commitment of public schools to the common good, to democracy, and recognizing that this goes so much further than, you know, numeracy and literacy scores. People seem to forget the contribution public education makes to the citizenry of a country and creating that kind of collective well-being and understanding that we value the common good. We value democracy. Johnny and I, we've had a couple episodes, Julian, where Johnny's been really laying into core democratic values and what those mean, and then really holding those up again and saying, boy, public education is just surrounded with core democratic values. Johnny, I don't know if you want to add a little bit there.
Well, yeah, I think you just summed it up, Tim. It's sort of we've said this, it's the bedrock of a strong democracy, is what we learn in schools together, and public education being those spaces where we come together locally to learn how to be together, both in our local communities, but then extend that out, how to function as a citizen of this country and of the world. Julian, so you shared some really helpful stuff around like what's happening in New Orleans, and you know how that's being, you know, held up as this great success that honestly, when you look at the numbers, isn't all that great. And we have international examples that are really attached to fascism, right? And that this choice thing isn't really about democracy. It's really about, you know, kind of defunding and creating industry around what's happening in schools. I'm going to flash forward a little bit, though, because I know there's some exciting stuff happening in your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
And as, you know, a former Detroit teacher, and as a, you know, loyal to the soil, a Detroit kid and teacher from a great state of education that went through a really rough time. Right. And so we saw a lot of charter schools just decimate the Detroit public school system, you know, and just wipe through, similar to New Orleans. But like, I hear really exciting things happening, especially around the idea that there's this teacher shortage. There's not enough good teachers.
Yeah.
And this is Michigan's a great state to become a teacher, but I know there's some exciting stuff happening. Share a little bit of the success coming out of Michigan, Julian.
Yeah. I think one of the great things, you know, while we were off air, you asked me about that transition from Kentucky to Michigan. And this is one of those places. In Kentucky, to address the teacher shortage, the legislators were talking about how can we create another quick alternative pathway to the classroom. In Michigan, the governor said, look, we know that people would like to attend higher education. They'd like to become teachers. And you know what? The state of Michigan is going to pay for it. And so what they did was, is they came up with millions of dollars. They gave it to districts. Districts decided to choose universities as their partners. And these are folk getting their undergraduate and graduate degrees. Grow your own programs is what they're called. And fortunately, Western Michigan was there's 15 public universities in Michigan, and 25% of the Grow Your Own students are attending Western. And that's something we're really proud of, because Western began as a teaching university back in 1903. I think it's 1903. And so I hope we get a chance to come on and really dig through how you solve the teacher shortage. And these are folks that are going into special ed, ESL. These are the, you know, because there are some places there aren't teacher shortages. Like, for example, social studies teachers, you know, districts get hundreds of applications for those jobs. If it's a physics teacher, they might get 3 or 4 applications. So we're also, the strategy is to address the shortage areas too.
Well, even the shortage areas, and you know, some of the work too, I've done, Jillian, along that, you know, with Grow Your Own, kind of looking at that and the teacher apprenticeship, and Johnny and I have had, you know, Tennessee, which where they had the first teacher apprenticeship, you know, recognized there too, the idea of this Grow Your Own. And but what you're talking about though is the possibility with Michigan though is a commitment from the citizens to make that move, to really say, and the way you pointed out it, we have a teacher shortage, and the solution to the teacher shortage is not fast track, low quality, low credential pathways for anybody who wants to teach. There are high quality pathways already established by institutions of higher education like Western Michigan, like you know, University of Wisconsin-Madison, Edgewood College, you know, Northland College way up there. They've got teacher education programs that have track records. That the commitment though, what I is so exciting is, if you can do it in Michigan, can we do it in Wisconsin? Can we do it in Ohio? Can we do it in Washington? Can we do it
And I remember, you know, when we were in California, I was asked to come testify about a teacher quality bill, and the legislature pulled the data for California on what was the likelihood of whether you would stay in the profession, stay in a school as an educator, if you came through an alternative pathway versus if you came through a university training program. And what was interesting was, so if you go to Vegas and I told you that your odds on a particular slot machine were 50% or 25%, which slot machine would you choose? Okay, I'm just metaphorically here, right? Well, you had about a 50% chance in California. Now, in Kentucky, if you came through a university program, that was about 80%, at least prior pandemic, it was around that. So it could have changed after, during the pandemic and after. So we also know that, you know, if you have a high-quality teacher, an experienced teacher, that a student will perform better over the long term, especially if you have 3 high-quality teachers in a row. So this is an investment worth making. Instead of trying to figure out what's the quickest, fastest way we can get someone off the street into a classroom, we need to make the investments. One more thought on this. The governor appointed me to the Professional Standards Board in Kentucky, and there was a provider coming from Texas, and they were an alt cert program, and they had 7,000 people paying them money to become teachers, and they ended up only certifying, I think, 1,500 of those 7,000 teachers. And so the question is that the right way to go about it? You have 7,000 people interested in teaching, but yet they only managed to graduate 1,500 of them. And so we want to inspire people to go into education. We want them to stay, because we know the instability that is created when teachers come and go, when teachers have high turnover, when you have high principal turnover. It creates instability in those schools, and the schools that need the stability, strong leadership, and high-quality teachers the most.
Absolutely. Hey, let's take a caller. L.A. Tom. L.A. Tom is there. We're always waiting. Tom, what's happening, my friend?
Hey, guys. First off, it's Thankful Thursday. Second, we the people ultimately are the government, and we must never forget that. Corporations are not the government. We the people are. And we must get money out of politics, and we must get money out of, the corrupt money out of education and what have you. I've been hearing more and more about superintendents, and, you know, Wisconsin's just been, since Scott Walker, has just been a disaster because of the fact that the union really is not as strong as it used to be because of Act 10 and people not being able to really, you know, support the union. But the reason I wanted to ask is, how did it happen in Finland when it went from being the worst education system in the world to now being the best. What did they do? What was it the tipping point? That,
L.A. Tom, let's we got an expert. Let's let Julian on that one.
There's a really good book about this, Tom, by Linda Darling Hammond and Frank Adamson. And what they did was is they went and they compared countries that were similar to each other across the world. And so Finland's comparison country was Sweden, which you'd expect Sweden would be a good comparison, being another Nordic country. Now, what Sweden did is they said, look, we're going to use markets, competition, all of the sort of market narrative that you hear. Finland said, we're going to focus on equity and making sure that every single student has opportunity. And that was their aim. That was their goal. So if you talk to Pasi Sahlberg, who was the deputy general, or I don't know his exact title, in Finland at the time, that's what they're going to talk about, is that they decided that they were going to focus on equity across the system. And what that did is that drove incredible achievement gains, while Sweden, focusing on market-based approaches to education, experienced exactly the opposite. And so they, in this interesting book by Linda Darling Hammond and Frank Adamson, they actually contrast countries that had an equity approach and an investment approach versus a market approach. And you saw radical transformations in countries that were invested in the equity approach.
Well, so there it is, L.A. Tom. You've been asking that question. Julian, appreciate that. The title of the book, do you have that on the top of your head there? Or are we looking for that?
Yeah, no, I don't have that. But if you just Google Frank Addison and Leonard Darling Hammond, I can't remember it off the top of my head. It came out about 3 or 4 years ago.
We'll make sure that that's out there on the podcast so that when people can download that. But Julian, man, we have covered a ton of ground with you tonight. And man, just really, you know, the work you're doing in Western Michigan, continue as with the Network for Public Education, the commitment to education deans for justice and equity. Man, dude, I'm thinking at this point, you're probably like, yeah, and when I get out of here, I'm going to bed, Tim and Johnny, man, because I got to start the next day. Julian, man, where's the blog, Cloaking Inequity?
Yeah, Cloaking Inequity. You can check me out on Twitter and Threads, Professor JVH. Also, add me on LinkedIn.
There Julian it is.
Julian Vasquez Heilig.
Awesome. Hey, Julian, you know what we say? Thanks for busting pencils, my friend. Yes, there it is. Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk, 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. That is the number. Give us a call. And, well, you've got L.A. Tom, our guest, Dr. Julian Vasquez Heilig. Thank you so much. And Joanne, we know you're there. Joanne, what's happening? Joanne, you still there?
Hey, guys. Cool thing. Our phone system crashed.
Oh, no. Oh, that's all right. We lost
Joanne. Well, it looks like Joanne is here to me, but it's because it's crashed. So, Joanne, if you're out there, I'm sorry you missed your call. I don't think you even can call back right now. So,
give it a try. It works. Hey, just while we were on the break, though, listeners, you know, Dr. Julian Vasquez Heilig with us tonight. It was awesome. Wow, he laid out so much. He always does so clearly. It's not, you know, a mistake that we have him defending public education before Congress when we need testimony to what's the what when it comes to charters and funding public education. But he referenced a book, and it's a banger of a book, Global Education Reform, Privatization Investment. And Linda Darling Hammond and, you know, Frank Adamson, you know, do that comparative work out there that helps share those models. So, you know, he referenced that great book. It's an awesome book. You know, I know students love to read it. So if you want to take a look at it and further understand that comparison, Global Education Reform, Privatization, Investment. And we got Joanne back. So, Joanne, what's happening?
Sorry, well, phone all went dead. I'm wondering about online education, though, the technology in education. I know that it wasn't too long ago that a number of charter schools were saying, yeah, we can have all these efficiencies and we can do so much better because we know how to handle online education and these other places don't. And public schools don't. And I'm just wondering, is anybody still holding the torch for online education and presenting it as a real option for the future?
Joanne, yes, there are different places. And in fact, I had a conversation today with some colleagues in the Madison area, Wisconsin, hopefully going to be coming on the show in the future. And using the teacher shortage also and moving and in fact realizing that for a lot of returning adults to come back and to become teachers, the ability to take classes online, mostly fully asynchronous, you know, at 2 a.m. when they have time because they're working full time in schools now in residencies, the idea of online asynchronous high quality online education is absolutely essential if you're looking at the teacher shortage as a way to get these really passionate people who have to be able to take their classes in a different format, in a different modality than most students. Johnny, so you're nodding away there.
Well, Tim, you know, I think, and Joanne, thanks for the call and thanks for bringing it up, because I don't think, especially after COVID, any education system, public, charter, or private, or for-profit, or nonprofit out there is, you know, able to ignore that for some folks, the utilization of technology, it opens access and it's in some cases, you know, a higher quality education for them. That's not for all students. So again, we remind ourselves there's not a one size fits all, and we have to be really able to adapt and offer, you know, a multitude of ways that education is both accessible and affordable and high quality. So I guess that's more than the both. That's it. It needs to be accessible, affordable, and high quality and relevant, right? So these pieces come together, and we've talked about it this week on the show. We keep hammering it. Things have to change, but it's not an either or. So, you know, I there's a lot of moments, Tim and Joanne and listeners, where even myself, I mean, I'm far more comfortable in person and doing school the way it's been most of my life. You know, I've been primarily socialized to understand teaching and learning is happening in person in real time, quote unquote, real time, right? In a classroom. That isn't the case anymore. We need to be able to adapt and understand that there are different needs for different learners and different demographics of students. So we kind of have to learn how to do both and do both well. And again, like with all things technological, you know, our human speed sort of is lagging behind that, the speed at which technology gets implemented. So there are a lot of really poor, I shouldn't even use the term poor, but I'm not sure. There are a lot of subpar, inadequate, terrible online programs. And yes, there are a lot of districts trying to figure out, a lot of institutions of learning trying to figure out how to improve that quality. So hopefully it catches up and we balance out. Joanne, you always call and remind us of that important aspect. It's not as easy as this or that, right, Tim? But, you know, we're on it. Like, I think good teachers out there are figuring out how to do both and do both
good teachers. And Johnny, that is one of the, you know, the hallmarks of online teaching is recognizing an institution commitment. As you said, first of all, recognizing that access for lots of students is going to be in different forms. And one of those forms is online, and making that shift to offering coursework that way really requires an investment also in preparing faculty and those who are going to teach online to create the best courses. I have seen it done well, and I have seen it done poorly. And when I've seen it done well, I have more faculty, Johnny, like you, who like prefer face-to-face socialization, know it, they love it, but come out of a very incredibly powerful online learning training and saying, you know what, I'm going to do well when I teach online. And boy, what I learned about teaching quality online is going to help me be even better when I'm in the classroom face to face. So the reality here is that maybe not an either or, but a commitment to quality through multiple modalities, as long as we're really putting forward there, Johnny, the realization that access, and that puts me down to going, and you want universal access? Well, that's public education. Public education is that access place where the commitment is to everybody, to all students, to all families, in realizing that. And so, you know, kind of bringing all, there's a whole lot of different topics that came in and out tonight. Ooh, you know, yes. Great callers here, and just really enjoying the kind of the breath that we've had tonight, you know, in the show. You know, our guest, Dr. Jillian Vasquez-Heilig from Western Michigan University, going all the way from charter schools, testimony in front of Congress, into then, you know, even answering L.A. Tom's question, Finland, what the heck did they do? Well, guess what Finland did? They made a commitment to equity and access across all of the students that are there in the system, and that's what did it. Busted Pencils, fully leaded. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow, hey, wrap it up for the week.
That's right.
See y'all tomorrow night. Join us.